WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Our Country Music Week continues with Tanya Tucker. She was a country music star by the age of 14, instantly distinctive for singing songs about madness, passion, and despair in a little girl's growl. Unlike a lot of child stars, however, she didn't fade away. Instead, Tucker has remained a central figure in country music into adulthood. In the 80s, she altered her image to include rock and roll and spandex, racking up hits as well as inches in the gossip columns for celebrity friendships that have included Cher, Don Johnson, and Glen Campbell. These days, she's the mother of two children and recognized as the precursor to today's teen country star Leanne Rimes. We're going to hear an interview Tanya Tucker recorded last year with our pop music critic Ken Tucker just after the publication of her autobiography Nickel Dreams, written in collaboration with her friend Patsy Bale Cox. First, let's hear her first hit, Delta Dawn.
Delta Dawn, what's that flower you have on? Could it be a faded rose from days gone by? And did I hear he was meeting you here today to take you to his mansion in the sky? She's 41 and her daddy still calls her baby. All the folks around Brownsville say she's crazy, 'cause she walks downtown with a suitcase in her looking for a mysterious dark-haired man. In her younger days, they called her Delta Dawn, prettiest one you ever laid eyes on. Then a man of low degree stood by her side, promised her he'd take her for his bride.
It sounds from reading your book that from a very young age, you were the one who wanted to pursue a career in show business rather than being pushed by your parents. Is that true?
Absolutely. You know, that was my dream, to be a country singer. I've never thought or dreamed about being anything else. And it was, I guess it's kind of strange to know what you want to be at such a young, age. But my dad saw that I had this dream, and so we sort of had the dream together. And we pursued it together.
And he ended up being your manager. And it seems, again, in reading the book, while he'd never had any great experience in show business, he comes off like a very smart, aggressive, protective guy in dealing with, you know, big-time concert promoters and record executives. What was it like to have your father as your manager?
Well, it's been a real blessing. I mean, not to say we don't have our good and bad times like any father and daughter, but it's just amazing. When I was writing the book with Patsy, some of the best times that I recalled, and some of the most, wonderful times to me was the early years of us trying to get started and going to Nashville when I was 9 the first time, and then the second time when I just turned 13, and of course recorded Delta Dawn in 1972.
Yeah.
And he's kicked a lot of doors down. He really has.
Probably literally.
Absolutely, absolutely. And he's been with me all along, and is my most trusted friend.
What was it like traveling around at such a young age when you were just starting out, before you were even signed to a record contract? I would imagine you didn't have a band. You were probably working with pickup bands that you would come to in each town. Is that right?
Exactly. I mean, we would go together, my dad and I, in a station wagon, and we would drive to different shows, and I think I was making around $600 a night.
Uh-huh.
So I had several number one records out, and I didn't have a band, and it was very difficult to get these musicians to listen to a 14-year-old kid.
I mean, I was going to say, how did you,
especially a girl?
Yeah, did you feel frustrated? Did you want to tell the band how you wanted your music played? What kind of accompaniment you wanted?
Absolutely, but of course, me, I really didn't have any musical background either. I mean, I've It was late. It kind of came later. So my dad didn't have any training as far as getting into the business. I mean, we knew nothing about it.
Mm-hmm. Do you think the industry has changed significantly in its attitudes toward child performers or a performer that comes right out of the box with a number one hit and what you have to do?
Yeah, I think it's changed totally, not just for child performers, but for everyone. I mean, there are so many people infiltrating, so many new artists infiltrating the business now. Sometimes it's a little hard to tell them apart, you know. But there's a lot of great music coming out of Nashville and a lot of great music coming out of country music. And that makes me feel really good because from where I started out, it was a lot different, a lot more difficult. When I started out, there was not that many female singers, not that many country girl singers. It was Tammy and Loretta, and that was about it, you know. And so there wasn't a whole, not to say they weren't competition, because they certainly were two of the greatest of all times, but there wasn't a whole lot of us. And now women in country music are just exploding. I mean, it's just amazing. We're drawing the big ticket, and we're selling the platinum albums, And we've come a long way.
Yeah.
I like to think I've been a part of that, you know?
Well, yeah, you certainly have. And before you, women singers in country music tended to be very polite, demure, mannerly.
Yes.
I mean, you were
lots of ruffles and lace.
Yeah, exactly.
Big hair.
right. And you were really the first person to say, hey, you know, women can get rowdy too and, you know, have a good time. I mean, I think that was an important thing when you came along to establish. Did you feel at the time that you were doing something different? Did people say, hey, don't act like that?
They do that all the time.
Yeah, still today.
They say that all the time.
Yeah.
When you're in the middle of the storm, it's hard to feel the wind blowing, I think, sometimes. I mean, I'm just so inside of it that I don't think I really noticed that change that much. If I did, the first time I did was when I did the TNT album. I went to L.A. and I recorded the TNT album. And that was, everybody thought I'd gone rock and roll, which that wasn't my... absolutely was not my motive. My motive was to do basically what Garth did, is just spread my wings, and I wanted the world to hear country music, and I knew that if they were exposed to it, that they would love it. But my image sort of changed as far as people were concerned, the public, when I cut that TNT album and I did the fold-out thing. And
yeah, I remember. I vividly remember
in
that.
The red spandex
and the spike heels and all that. It was
and
in fact,
the dynamite.
Right. I was living in L.A. at the time, and I remember a showcase that they had for you, I think at the Whiskey A Go-Go.
Right.
You performed there, and it was like
I think it was at the Roxy.
Oh, that's right. You're probably right.
It's the Roxy, yeah.
And it was a big deal, because it was like I was a rock critic at that point in L.A., and it was a big thing to get the rock press out and see you at that time. It was a real image change for you.
It really was, but it wasn't the one that I really wanted. I mean, I don't mind the image so much as the music I really didn't care for. I mean, it wasn't a good time for me.
Well, your first big hits were produced by the great Nashville producer Billy Sherrill.
That's right.
Who had worked with people like George Jones and Tammy Wynette.
You bet.
Was it intimidating to be 14 and working with what I would assume was a tough buzzard like him?
You know, it was absolutely wonderful.
Really?
We had a great relationship. And I look back over those times, and it was really quite something to... I've taken the chance to sign me. I mean, I was 12 years old when he signed me, and I turned 13, and we recorded Delta Dawn in May. I guess May 6th it came out was the release date on Delta Dawn when it hit the radio stations, and I had to really, really look back and think how wonderful that was, because I think if I would have fallen into the hands of someone else, that I wouldn't be here today.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, he listened to me. He listened to a 13-year-old girl, and when I said, I don't think that Happiest Girl in the Whole USA is my song. I just don't think it's my kind of song.
Was that a song that was originally given to you to sing?
Yes.
Really?
Yes.
So that became this big Donna Fargo hit.
Exactly.
That launched her career.
Absolutely. And we later, of course, became friends, and we discussed that, me and Donna.
Uh-huh.
But, of course, he played Delta Dawn for me, and I said, now that is my song.
I think that's amazing that at that young you would have that sense of yourself and the kind of material you should be doing.
Well, looking back over it's amazing to me, too, but not only that, but that he would listen to me.
Right.
You know, because here's this big major, I mean, everybody kept telling me, oh, Billy Sherrill, Billy. I didn't know who Billy, I didn't know a producer from Adam, you know what I mean?
Right.
I mean, I didn't know what they did.
Yeah.
So, I kind of got it kind of caught on after a while that this guy was really incredible talent and really an icon in Nashville at that time.
I'd like to play a little bit from one of your earliest hits, Billy Sherrill produced. This is Would You Lay With Me in a Field of Stone.
Would you lay with me in a field of stone if my needs were strong? Would you lay with me? Should my lips grow dry, would you wet them, dear, in the midnight hour if my lips were dry? Would you go blood away from my dying hand if I give myself to you? Will you bathe with me in the stream of life when the moon is full? Will you bathe with me? Will you still love me when I'm down and out in my time of trial? Will you stand by me? Would you go?
That's Tanya Tucker, one of her earliest songs. That song, as well as Delta Dawn, dealt with some very mature themes. Can you remember how you related to those songs at the time, what you thought about when you sang the lyrics? Because that song, Will You Lay With Me in a Field of Stone, people criticized you for it was interpreted as the sexual nature of the lyrics.
Yes, they did. And it was banned on a few stations, but it still went to number one.
Really?
It was a number one record for me. So it was written by David Allan Coe, mm-hmm. and he was a strange bird.
Yeah, one of the original outlaws.
Exactly. And later it became a very good friend of mine and still is. But he walked in and he had like seven of his wives with him. and he played Billy the song. He sang it to him. And of course, after he left, I kind of went, ooh, that was a weird one, man, right there. Ooh. And Billy said, it's a great song, though. We're going to cut it. And we did. And of course, we did get a lot of criticism. But David Allan Coe told me later that song he wrote as wedding vows for his brother's wedding. And I think when you listen to the song with that in mind, it changes it all around. It makes it something that's really, really strong. And it's the kind of love that, you know, I want to be loved like that. I think everybody does. Someone that would do those things for you has got to be someone that really loves you.
Mm-hmm.
So instead of a sexual connotation, it was more of a incredible, deep, emotional love, spiritual love, so to speak.
Mm-hmm.
And that was, I mean, I could understand that when I was 15 when I recorded that song. So I could understand that. I mean, I came from a lot of love. I mean, I've never known how it would feel not to be loved. And that song really was very, 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 very strong. Very strong.
We'll hear more of Tanya Tucker's interview with our pop critic Ken Tucker after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to Tanya Tucker speaking with our pop music critic Ken Tucker. Their interview was recorded last year after the publication of her autobiography, Nickel Dreams. In the 80s, Tanya Tucker was riding out a rocky period that included sagging record sales and a stint at the Betty Ford Clinic. She'd also entered into a stormy relationship with Glenn Campbell.
You write that you'd have these tremendous fights with him. You were both doing drugs. You'd stop and do cocaine and then start fighting again. These things were such epic. I mean, these sound like marathon sessions. And even though you're very specific about the violence involved, you say that he knocked your front teeth out in one fight.
Right.
Although I guess we should say he denies that.
Oh, well. Someone had to knock them out. I mean, yeah. I don't have them for some reason.
Yeah, they're just
but,
not
you know,
there.
A lot of that, those are some of the difficult things that were hard to talk about because, you know, I really, really don't want to hurt Glenn Campbell. And I mean, to me, he's been hurt enough and he's hurt himself enough. And
mm-hmm.
I just didn't want to be on that bandwagon. I care about him, and I want him to be happy. It was very difficult to write about personal things. I could have written a lot more,
mm-hmm.
but I don't figure that that anybody's life is going to be bettered by it. And I think it should be between me and Glenn and the good Lord, you know?
Mm-hmm.
I really don't think I feel like ratting on anybody.
Right.
And that was one of the difficult times for me in writing the book, is just trying to be careful but being honest at the same time. And I wanted to be totally honest.
Yeah, well, that's what strikes me in reading the book, is that, you know, everything gets, it's in the air now about that kind of physical abuse and that kind of thing.
But exactly.
I mean, this may be a politically incorrect question to say, but I wonder, when you're involved with somebody in a passionate way, isn't there a sense in which fighting almost becomes part of the love affair?
You know, it's true, especially when there's drugs and alcohol involved.
Mm-hmm.
It just becomes a real big cycle. And, I mean, we did, I have no doubt that we didn't really care about each other, but too many things were in the way. I mean, too many things. And now I'm not going to sit here and tell you that if there were no drugs or alcohol involved, that he and I would have made it. But we might have made it a little longer, I think.
Mm-hmm.
But it was just a time for me where I was coming into my own, and I was just becoming a grown woman, you know, at 22. And he'd been much twice my age. But I was certainly in awe of him, and I think it would be very dishonest to say I wasn't. He was a big hero to me, and one of the greatest singers I've ever known, and one of the greatest musicians. So we had some bad times, that's for sure, and I just hope I never have those kind of times again.
Well, lots of older country stars like Waylon Jennings and George Jones have complained that country music is now a young person's game, that only, you know, attractive guys and gals in their 20s get played on the radio.
Yeah.
You're certainly not as old as those guys, and your music is certainly played on the radio, but do you think they're basically right in that criticism?
I think they're right in a way, but I see no reason why Waylon Jennings couldn't have a hit record today. I think he's a great singer. He's one of our icons. He's a legend. I love to hear him, and I think it's just material. I think that Merle Haggard should have a number one record right now. I think Loretta Lynn should have records out. I mean, these people, I think, have just been in the business so long, they're kind of tired, and they kind of want to kick back. And I think that's probably what's kept me going, is I'm still wanting it. I'm still wanting to be out here. I'm still wanting to do it. I'm still young enough to feel like doing it. Instead of complaining, Waylon, I think we ought to go over and give Waylon a hit. I think he can still do it, you know?
Right. Well, I think one of the problems...
But it's true, though. It's true, though, Ken. A lot of... They're just not playing the old...
Right. That's what I was going to say, was that, you know, even before, just when Leanne Rimes put out Blue, one of the things you heard was that the industry saying, that's too country.
Yeah.
This absurd situation where country radio doesn't want to play anything that's too country because it has to somehow appeal to, you know, aging baby boomers
generation.
And rock and roll fans and stuff like that.
Yeah.
They
can't forget there's a few of us out here that really like to hear that country.
Yeah, yeah.
I like it real country.
That's right.
But I like everything. I like everything from Jimmy Rogers to Frank Sinatra. And I think there's a lot of other people out there, too. And I think we always try to categorize things too much.
Yeah, I mean, everything gets too kind of marked, segmented, and directed at, you know, specific audiences and all that
exactly.
kind of thing.
We'll come back around. Radio, you know, they're pretty smart. They'll get back around here.
Yeah, I mean, there's already this movement I keep hearing about called alternative country that's, you know, younger players doing very old-style honky-tonk country
exactly.
music.
Exactly, yeah.
I mean, that's the kind of stuff that I would think you want to hear more of.
Absolutely. I love it.
Yeah.
I'm ready for it. I mean, we're always ready for new faces, and I love the new faces, but I love them old faces, too.
Uh-huh.
And someone told me, they said, you know, have you ever thought about you are like part of the old and you're part of the new, but have you ever considered you might be a bridge between the two?
Mm-hmm.
And I thought that was the most beautiful compliment I've heard in my life.
Well, thank you so much for talking. It's really been great.
I love talking to you, Ken, and thanks so much. I hope I get to hang out with you again sometime.
Tanya Tucker spoke with Fresh Air pop critic Ken Tucker last year after the publication of her autobiography.